The Encouragement of the Scriptures was presented by Ron Julian on January 4, 2015 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2015. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Welcome to Reformation Fellowship. This will be a one-time talk, no series or anything. In fact, I want to focus today on one verse from Romans chapter 15. The context of Romans 15 is about the well-known issue of the weaker brother, and so we're going to have to talk about that a little bit, but in the end, that's not what we're talking about. Our focus is not on the issue of the weaker brother. In Romans 15, as we will see, Paul quotes Psalm 69, which we are also going to briefly look at. Psalm 69 concerns the persecution of the righteous by the unrighteous, and we will have to talk about that persecution a bit. But in the end, that is not our focus either. That is not what we're going to talk about. Our focus will be on one verse, Romans 15, verse 4. For whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope. So what we really want to talk about is the role of the Scriptures in our lives as believers. But you're going to have to be patient, because I'm going to talk about all kinds of things before I talk about that. So first, let's start with the overall context of Romans 14 and 15. They go together. Paul starts out in Romans 14:1. Now accept the one who is weak in faith, but not for the purpose of passing judgment on his opinions. One person has faith that he may eat all things, but he who is weak eats vegetables only. So we want to understand what the issue is in this passage so we can understand the verse that we're going to look at later on. The issue concerns a potential division amongst the believers in Rome. Despite how it might sound, it is not an argument over which diet is healthier, vegetarian or carnivore. It's a religious issue that has the potential to separate Jewish Christians from Gentile Christians. Should the genuine follower of God submit to certain dietary regulations for religious reasons? The Jewish Christians are inclined to say yes, the Gentile Christians are inclined to say no. In what follows, I will refer sometimes to the meat eaters and the vegetarians, but I just ask you to remember this is not a disagreement about a healthy diet. This is a religious disagreement. For our purposes, we are not going to worry about what exactly the dietary restrictions are. We're not going to worry about why the Jewish Christians felt that everyone should submit to those restrictions. All we need to know right now is that one group, and in the context, it seems pretty clear that it's largely Jewish, felt very strongly that everyone should abstain from eating meat, and another group, largely Gentile, felt that there was no need to submit to any dietary regulations. Everyone was free to eat meat or whatever they wanted to. There were no religious restrictions on what we ate. Paul says that the one who will only eat vegetables is weak in faith. Paul, in fact, agrees with those who feel free to eat the meat. From the perspective of whether there is a religious restriction or not, he would agree there is not a religious restriction. And so the understanding of the faith held by the vegetarians is weak. It is deficient. They're not understanding. They are wrongly telling everyone that we all must submit to these dietary regulations. But in this context, the issue isn't who is right and who is wrong. The issue is how the parties in this conflict are going to treat each other. So Paul makes two points. His first point is addressed to both groups, and his message is accept one another. Don't pass judgment on each other. And there's a lot that we could say about that. This is a great message, and he says some powerful things, but that is not our focus today. Our concern this afternoon is more with his second point, which starts in verse 13. In his second point, Paul turns to address the meat eaters. And basically, his message is this. You can't just do what you please. Yes, you have the religious freedom to eat the meat, but what effect are your actions going to have on the weaker brothers? You have to take that into account. So here's the situation as I understand it. For the person who feels the freedom to do something, there is a real temptation to feel hipper and cooler than those who don't. As Paul has already said, they are tempted to look with contempt upon those who won't eat the meat. And so a part of the temptation is to pressure those others to join the cool guys. Stop being so hung up about rules and regulations. Come on, loosen up and eat the meat. You know you want to. Paul, however, wants the meat eaters to look at the situation from the perspective of those on the other side. The vegetarians truly believe that to eat the meat is morally wrong, is an act of disobedience to God. If through your actions you pressure them to join you in eating the meat, you are pressuring them to violate their conscience. You are putting a stumbling block in front of them, he says. And what worse thing could I do to another person than to pressure them to disobey God? Turning away from God is the road to destruction. So in the first verses of chapter 15, Paul reminds the meat eaters that they have an obligation to their weaker brothers. They can't just do whatever they please. Their goal should be to edify their brothers, not trip them up. And that might mean that they might have to give up doing what they want to do, what pleases them, and do what would please the vegetarians, join them in not eating the meat. Okay, now immediately, let me just interrupt myself briefly here. This topic always raises a lot of questions. It's always interesting to people because immediately we start wondering, well, so what am I supposed to do? I mean, what if I know that there's a person who lives 30 miles away that I met once that believes that it isn't appropriate to whatever it is? Am I under obligation to not do that thing because they might get offended? And so we ask all these questions. When is it best to restrict my freedom? When is it best to exercise my freedom? Because we see Paul arguing for that as well at times. What principles would I use to sort that out? Those are all great questions, but remember, that's not what we're talking about today. The only reason that we're talking about this at all is to try to get the context in which Paul utters verse 4 of chapter 15. So for our purposes, it is enough to understand Paul's general point here. The meat eaters are not free to do whatever they please. They have to think about the implications of their actions on the weaker brothers. That's his second point that he made. The first point was to both groups, don't judge each other, accept each other. But his second point was to the meat eaters, you can't just do what you please. Even though you have the religious right to do it, that doesn't mean you should do it. You have to think about what the implications of that are going to be. This brings us to chapter 15, verse 3, right at the door of our verse for today. He's been talking about how they can't just please themselves. He says in verse 3, "For even Christ did not please himself, but as it is written, the reproaches of those who reproached you fell on me." So Paul uses Jesus as an example of the kind of self-sacrifice that he's talking about. This is a common thing for Paul to do. Of course, Jesus is our model of obedient self-sacrifice. If anyone had the right to do what he wants, it would be the king of the universe. And yet, he did not do just what he pleased. And as you probably suspect, Paul ultimately has in mind, which he often talks about, Jesus' willingness to die on the cross. Obviously, if Jesus were only concerned to please himself, he wouldn't have gone to the cross. That's fairly straightforward. What is of interest to us is the fact that Paul appeals to the Old Testament in making this point. He didn't have to. We have many examples of Paul just reminding us that Jesus was obedient unto death on the cross and that we should look to that model of self-sacrifice and so on. He says that in a number of places. But in this case, he decided to fill out his point by appealing to Psalm 69. Paul says, Jesus didn't just please himself, and let me make this point by quoting Psalm 69. So, in our discussion of Romans 15:4, which we're not going to get to for a while, we need to look at Psalm 69, because this is what inspires him to say what he says in the passage that we're concerned with. So, we're going to turn to Psalm 69 for just a few minutes. Psalm 69 is a psalm of David, and it begins, "Save me, O God, for the waters have threatened my life. I have sunk in deep mire, and there is no foothold. I have come into deep waters, and a flood overflows me. I am weary with my crying. My throat is parched. My eyes fail while I wait for my God." Psalm 69 is one of a number of psalms by David with a similar theme. David is surrounded by his enemies. He calls out to God for deliverance. David ends by declaring that God will indeed deliver him, and he urges his readers to put their trust in God. There are a number of psalms that are something along those lines. The New Testament writers often appeal to these psalms. They have a striking resonance with the life and sufferings of Christ. For one thing, some of David's language sounds a lot like the circumstances of Christ's life. Just recently, when Jack was going through Hebrews, we saw the great example of that, Psalm 22. David sounds as if he is describing the actual crucifixion of Christ. In 22:14, Psalm 22:14, "I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted within me. My strength is dried up like a potsherd, and my tongue cleaves to my jaws, and you lay me in the dust of death. For dogs have surrounded me. A band of evildoers has encompassed me. They pierced my hands and my feet. I can count all my bones. They look, they stare at me. They divide my garments among them, and for my clothing they cast lots." This is practically an account of the crucifixion straight out of the Gospels. As Jesus hangs on the cross, he seems to be thinking about his connection to this psalm because he cries out the famous first words of Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me?" On other occasions, Jesus makes connections between these psalms of David and his own life. Clearly, Jesus and his apostles see some sort of resonance between Christ's life and David's psalms, particularly the ones that speak of David's sufferings at the hands of his enemies. In this psalm we're looking at, Psalm 69, we can't help noticing that David says at one point about his tormentors, "They also gave me gall for my food, and for my thirst they gave me vinegar to drink," which sounds very familiar to us from the account of the crucifixion where they try to give Jesus gall and sour wine vinegar. So we might ask ourselves how these striking connections come about. Was David consciously prophesying about Jesus? Is God just orchestrating the circumstances of David's life to match the circumstances of Christ's life? How should we think about this? Is there really intended to be any connection at all? For myself, I'm still thinking about those questions, but what seems undeniable is this: Jesus and the apostles see some sort of connection between Jesus and the Psalms of David. There is, like I say, some sort of resonance between them. There's another important connection between David and Jesus, of course. David is the first to sit on the throne that one day will belong to Jesus. David is the first king in the Davidic line, and the promise is made that ultimately the throne will belong to a descendant of David who will rule on it forever. David himself is a Messiah, an anointed one of sorts. He is the anointed king sitting on the throne established by God. So, in some senses, David is the father of the great Messiah to come. And so it makes sense that there would be a connection between his life and the life of his greatest descendant. The most important connection between Jesus and these psalms, however, is that both David and Jesus are suffering because they have committed themselves to God. David's enemies are God's enemies. And so this brings us to the verse that Paul quotes in Romans 15. Let's start reading in Psalm 69 at verse 6, a few verses before. Psalm 69, verse 6, "May those who wait for you not be ashamed through me, O Lord God of hosts. May those who seek you not be dishonored through me, O God of Israel. Because for your sake I have borne reproach, dishonor has covered my face. I have become estranged from my brothers and an alien to my mother's sons. For zeal for your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me." David is not suffering for his own sake. That is, he is not suffering because people don't like his personality or because he cheated someone in a business deal or anything like that. David is suffering for God's sake. Those who hate God also hate David. That is brought out most strongly in verse 9. "Zeal for your house has consumed me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me." And you may notice this is the verse that Paul is quoting in Romans 15, which we'll get to in a minute. In order to make verse 9 clear, though, what exactly is the import of what David is saying there, I need to explain a few things. So again, I ask for your patience. First of all, David is writing Hebrew poetry, and Hebrew poetry has a certain quality. There are certain things that characterize Hebrew poetry. The main feature of Hebrew poetry, what is important to us as we try to understand it, is what we call parallelism. Typically, the lines in a Hebrew poem go together in pairs, or sometimes three, occasionally, very occasionally four, but typically they're in pairs. And the two lines are meant to work together to produce the meaning. Sometimes they virtually say the same thing, just using different language. We just saw, "I have become estranged from my brothers and an alien to my mother's sons." Okay, well, what's the difference between my brothers and my mother's sons? Nothing. It's just two different ways of saying the same thing. Sometimes the relationship between the pairs is a little richer than that, but the idea is that they work together to produce one meaning. So let me look at just one example to show you what I'm talking about. There are many examples, there are many different examples in this psalm, but let me just pick verse 12 just as an example of the sort of thing that we're talking about. "Those who sit in the gate talk about me, and I am the song of the drunkards." Okay, so these two verses don't mean exactly the same thing. They're saying something different, but together they are communicating one idea. First, those who sit in the gate talk about me. The gate of the town is where people hang around and gossip. So people are hanging around at the gate talking about the psalmist. In this context, given that he's talking about how all his enemies are against him and all of this, what they're talking about is probably not complimentary. But we could ask the question, what are they saying about him? Are they, maybe they're praising him for his fine character. Well, that's where the next line comes in, "and I am the song of the drunkards." Now we get a clearer picture. We can't really imagine that the drunkards are singing a song of praise. Presumably they're making fun of him. They're mocking him, perhaps obscenely mocking him as they're rolling around singing obscene verses about this idiot David. So these two pictures work together. People are sitting at the gate talking about me. Drunkards are singing mocking songs about me. Together, these lines work together to communicate the rich picture of everyone is saying bad things about me. Everyone's talking about me and none of it is good. Well, that is how I understand verse 9 to be working, the verse that we're concerned with. First it says, "Zeal for your house has consumed me." Next it says, "And the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me." And these two lines are meant to work together to create one idea. And we're going to have to talk about what that idea is, because this is what Paul's quoting in Romans 15. So we need to understand what he thinks is going on here. In order to understand how they work together, we need to talk about this word consume. What does it mean that zeal for God's house has consumed him? In our English idiom, sometimes it can be relatively benign and even good to be consumed with something. If I have started a new charity to help the poor, I might say, "Oh, I don't have time to go to the movies anymore. My enthusiasm for my new charity has consumed me. That enthusiasm has taken up my life. I have lost everything else to it. I don't go to the movies. I don't do anything except work toward my charity because that's where my enthusiasm is." Is that a bad thing, that I have been consumed by that? Presumably not. If it's a good and worthy way to spend my time, why not be consumed by that? Notice sometimes, though, that our English idiom has a darker tone to it. We might say of someone that he is consumed with jealousy. Jealousy has eaten up his life, and this is not a good thing. He has lost everything that used to make up his life. He can't eat, he can't concentrate on his work, he can't hang out with his friends. He has lost everything because his jealousy has eaten him up. It has consumed away what he used to have as his life. And that's a bad thing. Well, my understanding is that the Hebrew idiom has this negative and even stronger negative sense. When he says, "Zeal for God's house has consumed him," he's saying, it has taken everything. Because he has a zeal for God's house, everything that used to make up his life is gone. He has been eaten up, consumed, even destroyed by this zeal. Why? Why would that be? Has he lost everything because he sits around thinking about God's house all day? I suppose that's possible. But when we look at the next line, we can see what he has in mind. He says, "And the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me." And to be clear here, the "you" that we're talking about is God. There are those who would reproach God. They hate God. They dismiss God. They have something against God. But who is it that's getting the brunt of their attack? David is. The psalmist is. "God, you are the one they don't like, but I, myself, am the one who is getting it in the neck." We can see then that these two lines together emphasize the idea that the psalmist is suffering because of his commitment to God. And it's this contrast, I think, between the "you" and the "me," the "I." God, my zeal is for your house, but I am the one being consumed, the one losing everything, the one being destroyed. God, their hatred is for you, but I am the one they are reproaching. Notice that David is clearly implying that this is not about him. If David had not committed himself to God, none of this would be happening. He is not suffering because of anything about himself. He is suffering because he has chosen to follow God. We might say, David is not pleasing himself. That is, obviously, it would be better for him in the short term to not make enemies of everyone around him. He could just live his life and not make waves. He could easily find a way to live that wouldn't get him in so much trouble. But he is not just pleasing himself. He is committed to God. He has a zeal for God's house. He is following God. He trusts God. And in his situation, a necessary part of being committed to God is being hated by those who hate God. They don't like you, and I'm the one who's paying for it. In Romans 15, Paul associates this verse with Jesus. Jesus did not just please himself, but as it is written, "The reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me." Jesus chose to follow God, not just please himself. And ultimately, those who reject God ended up rejecting and killing Jesus. Paul, for however we explain the connection, Paul is highlighting this connection between the sufferings of David, as recounted in Psalm 69, and the sufferings of Christ, and which led ultimately to his death. As it happens, Paul is not the first one to associate Psalm 69 with Jesus and his death, at least how I would understand it. In John chapter 2, we read about Jesus throwing the money changers out of the temple, and I'll try to make this brief, but Jesus does this on behalf of the Father. He says, "Stop making my Father's house a place of business." And at this point, John says, his disciples remembered Psalm 69. "Zeal for your house will consume me." But let's note two things very carefully here. First of all, we remember that this means something like, "Zeal for your house will cost me everything, will destroy me." The disciples are thinking about how in the psalm, zeal for God's house ended up costing the psalmist so dearly. And they're thinking about Jesus. In other words, they are worried about how this is going to turn out. Jesus just marched into the temple area. He overturned tables and drove out the animals. This is the kind of thing that could get you in trouble. This is the kind of thing that could get you in big trouble. Secondly, we notice that John renders the verse in the future tense. In the original, it says, "Zeal for your house has consumed me." Here it says, "Zeal for your house will consume me." And I think that's because in the situation, as the disciples are thinking about it, this zeal has not consumed Jesus yet. It has not cost him. So far, he has the upper hand. But it will. Ultimately, the enemies that he is making through this and other things that he does in his interactions with the Jewish leadership, ultimately it is going to lead to his death. And in fact, that's what Jesus goes on to talk about. The Jews basically ask Jesus, "Who do you think you are? Show us a sign that you have the right to do this." And Jesus says, "Okay, I'll show you a sign. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." And then John tells us that Jesus was talking about the temple of his body. As is true in almost everything in the Gospel of John, Jesus never says anything straightforward. He always says it metaphorically or in some way that you have to stop and figure out what the heck he's talking about. But in essence, what Jesus is saying is, "You want a sign to prove that I have the right to do this? Kill me, and in 3 days I will rise again." And of course, that is exactly what happened. So here's the story. Here's what we see in John. Jesus throws out the money changers, a provocative act that could make him many enemies. The disciples remember Psalm 69, worrying that zeal for God's house will destroy Jesus. Jesus then speaks metaphorically and says that if the Jews kill him, he will rise again in 3 days. And after the resurrection, the disciples remember all this and see that that is exactly what happened. And Jesus did rise from the dead after the Jewish leaders indeed did kill Jesus, just as the disciples feared they would. Okay, so remember, why am I talking about this episode from John? Because here we see an early example of Jesus' disciples associating in their minds a psalm of David, in this particular case Psalm 69, with the ultimate death of Jesus. David describes losing everything because he committed himself to God. Those who reject God rejected him, and that is what happened to Jesus. Jesus was obedient to the Father, and those who reject the Father rejected him, ultimately killing him. So, let me try to sum up what we have so far. Remember, we haven't actually gotten to our verse that we're talking about today, but let me tell you where we are, because we're almost there. In Romans 14 and 15, Paul is addressing a deep religious division. Some think we must submit to dietary restrictions for religious reasons. Others think we are free to eat whatever we want. Paul makes two points. First, they need to accept each other in spite of their religious differences on this point. And second, those who feel free to eat should not just think about what they want. They should not just please themselves. They should think about what God would want, which is for them not to put a stumbling block in front of their brothers. To support this second point, Paul appeals to the example of Jesus. Jesus did not just please himself. He sacrificed his own welfare to obediently give his life on the cross. Obviously, for his own sake, he certainly didn't want to die on the cross, but as an act of obedience to God and love for his brothers, he gave up his own welfare and died on the cross. And then, interestingly, Paul makes this point about Jesus by referring back to Psalm 69, a psalm that resonates with the themes of Jesus' suffering and death. In the psalm, we see that David suffers because he is following God. If he were to just please himself, if he were to just mind his own business, he wouldn't be facing these hardships. It is because he is following God that these hardships have come upon him. Is he sorry? Does he want to stop following God? No. He trusts God to deliver him. He says so explicitly. But he is making it clear, on my own, I wouldn't have gotten into this situation. It is because of you, God, that I am facing these hardships. Well, that is exactly what is true about Jesus. He could have stayed a carpenter all his life and died at a ripe old age. He got into difficulty for God's sake. It is because he pursued what God wanted that he ended up dying on a cross. And so, Paul is saying, that is true for the meat eaters as well. The issue is not persecution this time. It's not the people who hate God hate you. That's not at all what's at stake. The issue this time is the freedom to eat whatever they want. But the principle is the same. If the meat eaters just ignored God, if they just pursued their own desires, then they could eat whatever meat they wanted whenever they wanted to. But they are, so they say, following God, and so they cannot just please themselves. How can they follow God and yet deliberately put a stumbling block in front of somebody else? How can they follow God and not care that they are leading someone potentially to their spiritual destruction? They can't just please themselves. They have to think about how their brothers are going to be affected by this. Just like David, just like Jesus, they find that following God involves saying no to themselves. Okay, so my sermon is almost over, and we finally come to the verse that I am teaching on, which is Romans 15:4. Paul says, "For whatever was written in earlier times was written for our instruction, so that through perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope." This is what I want to talk about, but we needed to get the background to all of that so that we could understand what Paul's doing here. First of all, let's look at the point that he's making, try to understand what he's saying here, and then connect it up with what he's just done with the psalm. Obviously, this is a sort of a side comment by Paul. The topic has been how to deal with the weaker brother, but Paul stops to comment on the fact that he chose to make his point by quoting a verse from a psalm. Why do that? Why not just make your point and move on? He wants to talk about the purpose of such scriptures for us now. He wants to talk about how we interact with them, what they mean to us, how they affect us. So what does he say? First of all, he says that what was written in earlier times was written for our instruction. This is a point that Paul makes a number of times in his letters. We should read an old text like Psalm 69 with the expectation that God is going to use it to teach us. As Paul says elsewhere in 2 Timothy 3:16, all scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, so that the man of God may be adequate, equipped for every good work. And when he says this, he's in particular talking about the Old Testament, which are the scriptures that they had when he was writing. The scriptures are not just a historical text, they are inspired by God, intended to teach and correct us, he's saying. And that teaching, that instruction that he talks about here, has a goal. It has an ultimate purpose. And that purpose is wrapped up in these four concepts that Paul talks about in this verse: the scriptures, perseverance, encouragement, and hope. So let's talk about those things a little bit. Start with hope, the ultimate goal. The biblical concept of hope is something like this. Hope is a confident expectation that a desirable thing will indeed happen. It is a confident expectation that a desirable event will come about. But hope in the biblical sense is not an easy thing to come by because of the nature of what we're hoping in. The Bible promises that the day is coming when evil and death and suffering will be gone. The day is coming when Jesus will return and life will be full and glorious forever. But in the midst of the challenges of this life, it is hard to hold on to the confident expectation that this is what's going to happen. I have more confidence that the UPS will deliver the package that I ordered from Amazon than I have that God will keep his promise to give me a joyous life of goodness forever. One of those things is a lot easier to believe than the other. The sort of hope that we're talking about here is the child of faith. The more I grow in my belief in God's promises and my trust in God, the stronger my hope becomes. Ultimately, as a side note, we say hope is a miraculous work of God. That's what Paul says a few verses later in verse 13. Now may the God of hope fill you with all joy and peace in believing, so that you will abound in hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. To be filled with hope, ultimately, is a miraculous act of the Holy Spirit in the lives of believers, rooted in the fact that the Spirit, the power of God, is working to strengthen our faith. As our faith grows, our hope grows. In the verse that we're looking at today, verse 4, Paul is associating hope as coming through two things, perseverance and the encouragement of the Scriptures. Let's take the second one first, the encouragement of the Scriptures. The Scriptures tell us what our true situation in the world is. The Scriptures report to us the promises of God. They tell us why we should have hope, but they also tell us the implications of that hope for our lives today. They tell us what it means to follow God. They tell us how a person of faith should live. They call us to persevere in faith and remind us what that looks like. So the Scriptures, on the one hand, tell us the hard truth about what it means to follow God today, but they also tell us how it will all turn out gloriously right in the end. In one sense, the message of the Bible can be summed up in one statement of Jesus, found in John 16:33. In the world you have tribulation, but take courage, I have overcome the world. We need to know that in this world we have tribulation. We don't want to have false hopes. We don't want to get the idea that somehow we are going to be immune from that trouble. We need to know what to expect so that we can be prepared, so that we can persevere. But we also need hope. We need to know that Jesus has overcome the world. We need to know that everything will turn out well. We need to have hope. So this is what the Scriptures do for us. They tell us what we must face today. They tell us what we can hope for tomorrow. The Scriptures help to encourage us, to give us the courage to persevere by telling us these things. And as Paul says, hope comes through perseverance. This is a topic that we could talk about for a long time. Those of you who have heard me teach before know that it's a topic that I do talk about a lot, the connection between our personal hope and confidence that indeed we have this destiny in front of us and going through trials, persevering in faith. We gain in the not just the abstract idea that there is a hope out there one day for people, but the personal conviction that I indeed am one who is going to inherit those promises, that I have a well-founded hope, because God takes us through situations in life that we can look back on over time and see through the ups and downs, I have hung in there. I have persevered in the faith. I have learned that the promises of the gospel mean something to me in the midst of the real difficulties of life. This is what Paul says in verse 8, that God, in fact, himself is the source of these things. God is the God of perseverance and encouragement. So just as hope is a work of the power of the Holy Spirit, so the perseverance that leads to hope is a work of God in our lives. So let me restate the picture that Paul is giving us in this section. God gives us hope by the power of the Holy Spirit. He gives us this hope by strengthening our faith. We persevere in this faith through the power of God, and then this perseverance strengthens our hope, provides us evidence that we are indeed children of God with a great hope. And the scriptures have a role to play in this process. They tell us about our great hope. They remind us of our great hope, and they urge us to keep our minds set on our great hope. And they tell us what the implications are of having such a hope for the way we live today. They remind us that God is going in a different direction than the world around us. To follow God means being at odds with this world in many ways. To follow God means persevering in believing the gospel, even when that belief costs me. The scriptures keep reminding us over and over again, this is the way it is. This is the road to real life. Persevere in believing that the gospel is true. Keep living as if the gospel were true. Treat other people as if the gospel were true, and on and on. The scriptures contribute to our hope because they remind us what our hope is, and they encourage us in the midst of the difficulties of our lives today to remind us, what does it mean to be a believer in the midst of my own life? Okay, so now let's bring this back to Romans 15:4 that we're looking at. There is a group of people who believe rightly that they are free to eat whatever they want, but they are facing a challenging situation. They're in fellowship with other believers who believe it is wrong to eat the meat. How are the meat eaters going to respond? What are they going to do? The temptation is to look on the vegetarians with contempt. And the further temptation is to put pressure on the vegetarians to eat the meat themselves. The meat eaters are thinking, these Jews and their dietary regulations are so hung up. Let's show them that they need to join us in being free. But in fact, they are pressuring the Jewish believers to do something they believe is wrong. And so, they are pressuring the Jewish believers to disobey God, to violate their conscience, which could lead to their spiritual destruction. And so Paul is saying to the meat eaters, you can't just do whatever you want. Following God has implications. Yes, if you are just doing whatever you want, you could eat the meat. But you are following the God who sent Jesus to die for these Jewish Christians. God is calling them to live lives of faithfulness, just as he is calling you to live a life of faithfulness. You can't just please yourself. And now, here is where the scriptures come in. Psalm 69 shows us David, the king, the faithful man of God, suffering because he is committed to God. He isn't just going his own way. He isn't pleasing himself. He is committed to God, even though it has cost him things that he wanted to keep. And this psalm gives us the picture of the great King Jesus doing exactly the same thing. Jesus was committed to obeying God, even though it cost him his life on the cross. He didn't just go his own way. He didn't just please himself. And so the psalm should instruct and encourage the meat eaters in Rome. It shows them what's true. It shows them what it means to be a follower of God. Following God sometimes means consequences that you would not have chosen for yourself. David would not have chosen to be the laughingstock of the drunkards, but that is what came of faithfully following God. Jesus would not have chosen for himself to die on a cross, but that is what came of faithfully following God. This is just the truth. When the scriptures show us this reality, it's telling us the way things are. Sometimes like for David, like for Jesus, when you follow God, you're going to end up having to say no to yourself. You're going to end up going places that you would rather not have gone. We need to know that life is like this sometimes. And so the meat eaters need to see that faithfully following God has implications for them. If in fact they are tempting the weaker brothers to their doom, then the meat eaters need to stop eating the meat. Being a faithful follower of God means that sometimes I can't do what I please. In Psalm 69, David reminds us that this is true, but he also concludes in that psalm with his confidence that God will make things right in the end. David ends the psalm in hope. He tells us that we are right to put our confidence in God, whatever the cost may be at the present time. And so Psalm 69 does what the scriptures always do. It reminds us of our hope in God, and it reminds us of the implications of that hope for how we live today. So Paul is saying that what we see in the life of Jesus, what we see through the psalm in the life of David, which resonates with what we see in Jesus, those truths instruct and encourage us. They tell us how it is. They tell us what it looks like to be a follower of God. They encourage us to hang in there, to persevere in the midst of it, because in the end, our hope will be real, will be realized, and be worthwhile. Reformation Fellowship is a group that is focused on the scriptures. You may have noticed that. This is a strange place in many ways. I always like it that when people hang around for a while and don't leave, because I know that there are many reasons to leave when you come to Reformation Fellowship. It is a weird little place. But I think that whatever is good about us comes from the fact that we are committed to trying to understand the scriptures. And so a verse like this, where Paul is stepping back and commenting on the role of the scriptures in our lives, is very significant to me. There are all sorts of benefits from learning about the scriptures. We could talk about all sorts of reasons why it would be good to know the Bible better. But I think that Paul has really captured what for him is the essential part of what the scriptures should mean to us. The scriptures remind us who God is and what he has promised. They feed our hope. And then they remind us of the sometimes hard truths about what it looks like to follow him in the present age. And we need to be reminded of that to encourage us to follow what is true. Okay, so that's what I have to say today. So this is a time when you can ask any questions or make any comments, and Roger will bring you the mic.
When you face reality, when you're at odds with somebody else, whether it's because of political viewpoints or religious viewpoints, I know Michael was talking about this when he was talking about somebody with different political viewpoints, and I could relate to what he said. It becomes more of a point that I'm going to make my point and I'm going to be right and make sure I'm right, rather than approaching it from in a different point of view, whatever right. that is. The other way is so unnatural for me that I can't hardly even relate right. to it. So
how do we describe it?
Yeah. And so that's the reality of, I think, what you're talking about here. And then you bring up a point. There's another side of it, in that when you believe from a biblical truth, that you are absolutely convinced that your point of view just has to be right. That's a little bit different than a political point of view to me, where, okay, we have different points of view, but so what?
Right.
But it makes a whole lot of difference when you believe in your heart that this is against what God would want, I guess, is right. what I'm saying.
Right. Well, certainly, I have two things to say. The last thing you said about the difference between those things, that's certainly true for me. I get up here and I try to make the case for what I think the Bible is saying, what the gospel is saying, and what should I say? I'm not ashamed. I'm not hesitant about getting up and saying, okay, I think isn't this in fact what this is doing? If it isn't, then let's talk about it and figure out what it is saying. But we have an obligation to understand this thing and follow what it's saying. You will almost never find me making political comments, not even in private life. It's not that I don't have political opinions. I have political opinions. But my level of confidence in my political opinions is of a lower order than my level of confidence in my fundamental understanding of the gospel and what that means for my life. So yeah, there is that. There are many things in life where we would do well to just humbly admit that I have a lot to learn. And I have a lot to learn when it comes to the Bible too, but there are those places where we personally make our stand, and yeah, that's an important thing. We have to make a stand somewhere. We can't be blown by every wind. I mean, we have to decide what ultimately our life is going to be about. That thing that you were searching, trying to describe that thing on the other side, in a way, I think it's very easy. The Bible has a very simple answer to what that thing is. We, by nature, I mean, I don't know, maybe there are people that by nature are not like this. They have other tendencies. But I know in myself that I have that urge to win, to prevail. I wouldn't even want you to know how many times I have stood in the shower playing out some sort of fantasy of how I'm going to find the perfect thing to say that is going to make me prevail in some situation, that everyone is going to bow down and say, yes, Ron has been right all along, that sort of thing. That urge can just lead to all sorts of terrible things. What's the opposite? The opposite of it is love. That is, what Jesus expressed his opinion powerfully. He didn't hold back. But what was motivating him was a love for God and a love for us. So what we are striving to do in the midst of all of this is to become people who are concerned about the other person. We have this disagreement. There's no one automatic answer. Should we talk about it? Should I try to convince you that I'm right? Or would it be better to hold off and talk about this later? I mean, there's all sorts of ins and outs to those questions. And we can't say this is automatically always the way you ought to handle it. But we can say automatically that this is what always ought to be our goal is, what is for the benefit of the other person, even if it makes me look bad. We talked about that when we were looking at 2 Corinthians. Paul, and I believe him when he was saying it, was basically saying to his opponents, I'm not trying to win here. I would be willing if somehow everyone could embrace the truth, even though it made me look like a fool, even though it made me look like I lost. I don't care. I don't care whether I win. I don't care how I come off. What I care about is you and whether you find life or not. So, yeah, that's the sort of people we want to be, is in the midst of all of those ins and outs, the difficulties, the disagreements, the places where we have that choice to make, what am I going to say? The place to start is to go back to that question, what's motivating me? That is, let me back up on that. I don't mean it's the time to get introspective and think, what am I really about? I mean, practically speaking, I'm asking myself the question, to the best of my ability, I'm asking the question, what do I think would be good for the other person? And that's what I'm going to try to do. And we don't often know. Sometimes we often feel, I mean, I don't know about you, but I feel like my batting average is not very good. That the choice to speak or the choice not to speak, more often than not, I end up thinking, well, that probably wasn't the thing to do. So, I mean, it's hard. It's difficult to know at times what to do, but that's where we start. That's what it's about. And that's, Paul doesn't use the words here, but that's what's motivating what he's getting at here, is it's basically being concerned for the other guy. As he puts it at the beginning of 15, you who are strong need to be concerned about the weaknesses. Take on the weaknesses of the other. If they're not understanding it well, then that puts you in the position where you have all the more responsibility to be looking out for them. Don't look at them with contempt. Don't try to manipulate them into agreeing with you. Think about what you can do to edify them, he says, to encourage them to go the right way, which is an act of love. It's an act of what would be good for that person.
Yeah, that helped. It's just amazing how easy it is to slip from trying to make a point and then having to be, at least for me. It's an easy slip.
No, it is an easy slip. I'm a professional discusser. For many, many years, I've been involved in discussions where I'm the leader of the discussion. And I go into it knowing that my goal is to facilitate discussion and to encourage people to be involved and all that stuff. And I'm not saying whether I'm successful at that or not, but most of the time I manage to remember that that's what I'm supposed to be doing and that I try to do that. Every now and again, I wake up at the end of a discussion. Thankfully, it doesn't happen very often, but every now and again, I wake up at the end of a discussion and realize I have just been arguing. I just got it in my mind that I had to win this argument about this thing, and everything, the whole thing has gone out the window. I'm not thinking about how can I help people understand. I'm not thinking about how can I facilitate discussion. I'm just thinking, I need to win this argument, and I don't even know, how did this happen? How did this happen? It's embarrassing. Really. I mean, I have had people call me on it on occasion, say, you know, that wasn't, and what can I say except you're absolutely right. I mean, there was no doubt about it.
I'm just thinking about the opposite of that, though, which is apathy, where you're with people that you are in different of opinion, and you just shut down and freeze. And that, I mean, because it's happened to me before, where you either think, well, am I going to discuss this, or am I going to walk away from this and just not want to be with this person anymore? Isn't that just as terrible? And when you think that's not loving them either.
Right. Well, you
know, and I'm not saying that one is more loving than another. I'm saying neither is loving.
Right. Yes. I mean, I agree with that exactly. All I'm saying is that it's hard to say in advance to tell you when you get in this situation, this is the thing you should do. You should speak or you shouldn't speak. We're using our judgment on what is the most loving thing to do in this situation. But you're right. One person might say nothing because they think, this is not the time. This is not going to help. I'm just going to patiently wait this out and see how this goes. Whereas another person in the same situation might choose to say nothing because they don't care. They just don't want to be involved. You know?
It seems like that we do that a lot. As people, it's a lot easier to shut down or walk away, which isn't very loving either.
Right.
One question is, does it matter what the meat is being discussed?
Well, yeah, to understand this passage, the entire 14 and 15 fully, yeah, it's a religious disagreement because in 15, he starts talking about how the Gentiles have been accepted by God, and he points to the Old Testament showing that all the nations, not just Israel, are going to be included in all this stuff. It does seem clear that there's a Jew-Gentile difference of perspective that is fueling this thing. Since it was not a part of the Jewish dietary restrictions to eat no meat at all, and yet he describes it as they eat only vegetables, we could put it together in various ways, probably. I have always thought that the most likely thing is that it might be a similar thing to what he talks about in 1 Corinthians, which is the issue of eating the meat that is sold in the meat market and whether it is sacrificed to idols or not. So that it could be a similar issue is that the Jews in particular are horrified at the idea of eating something that would make them impure or that sort of thing. So yeah, it's debated. When you read commentaries and stuff on Romans, people kick around, well, what is it exactly that's going on? But like I say, what is clear to me is that Paul says that we ought to think about each other in this situation as the one who feels free to eat the meat should remember that the one who does not feel that freedom is, after all, doing this out of a desire to obey God. And that's a good thing, and that's what I should look at it that way. And likewise, the person who believes that you shouldn't do it should remember that the person who feels the freedom to eat is not necessarily doing it out of disobedience to God. They believe that God has given them the freedom to eat this, and as he says, they're eating with gratitude. Thanks God for giving us this meat to eat. And so each side should recognize what is good about where the other is coming from, is that there is a commitment to God that is being demonstrated by both sides. We also know, though, that at times Paul would seem more involved in an issue like this. It is not necessarily the case that the person who feels the freedom to eat is doing so out of good motives. In 1 Corinthians, Paul makes it clear that those hip Corinthians who feel the freedom to eat the meat sacrificed to idols, they actually kind of get a thrill from the idea, hey, we're eating meat sacrificed to idols. It's, you know, pretty edgy, pretty cool. And Paul warns them in these strong terms about flirting with idolatry. What are you doing? So on the one hand, yeah, you have the freedom to eat the meat. That freedom is really rooted in the fact that it doesn't bother you that you're involving yourself in something that is against God, then you have a real serious problem. And likewise, for the one who is obeying God as they understand it in doing the restrictions, we know from what Paul says that that can be rooted in self-righteousness and a lack of recognition that I'm being saved not by my performance of religious rituals, but by the grace of God. So, in answer to your question, without knowing exactly what's going on, I think we can see the general principles involved there, that a difference in perspective on what God wants us to do that is not rooted in hostility toward God, but is just rooted in a different understanding, perhaps on one side, a deficient understanding. Paul thinks that those who are following the dietary restrictions have a deficient understanding. That's not required. We don't need to do that. But we can respect that each side is doing what they're doing out of a desire to follow God. On the other hand, we can also recognize that these sorts of differences can be rooted in hostility to God, either a licentious desire to do whatever I want or a self-righteous impulse to demonstrate that I'm one of the good guys because I keep the rules. So those principles, I think, emerge from here and 1 Corinthians and Galatians and Romans. When you put all that stuff together, we can see that in general, those are the issues. Those are what we're facing, even though it may be difficult to exactly pin down in the Romans case. Are we certain exactly what is motivating those who won't eat? What exactly are they thinking is the reason that they shouldn't eat? We're kind of guessing with that. But I think the principle is fairly clear.
But neither one can be accused of importing something into their belief system that wasn't biblical to begin with.
By that, do you mean that we could...
There's not a Pharisee at the table.
Yeah, I would say that. Yeah, that if Paul thought that the following the dietary restrictions was rooted in a Pharisaical sort of understanding of our relationship with God, then he would be fighting it. So the fact that he's not would indicate that in general, that's not how he sees the issue there. Although, obviously, he's speaking to generally to a group that he doesn't know as well as, say, he did the Corinthians. It's interesting that with the Corinthians, he's much more pointed about the potential problems and his criticisms of what's going on because he knew them very well and what was going on there. In Romans, he doesn't know them as well, so he's speaking more generally on that topic, I think.
The reason I asked about the Pharisees is because there's a difference between two people pursuing sincerely an understanding of something that has been revealed to them. You're a Jew, you shouldn't eat pork, and you mm-hmm. shouldn't eat meat sacrificed to idols and blah, blah, blah. Okay, at one time that was definitely true because they had not been mm-hmm. made clean. Here's a Gentile who never had those restrictions, abandoned the idols of his culture, but he'll still eat the meat because it's the cheapest and best cuts in the market. Now, they're sitting at the same table, and they're both right. Until the Jew recognizes that God had declared all things clean, they can just say, well, that's where we are right now. But if someone comes in with something that is not in the faith, that is not a tenet of faith, has never been declared by an authority to be a tenet of the faith, and defends that as okay or not okay, do we have to listen to them?
Well, Okay, this is just off the top of my head, but I think if I'm understanding your question, the answer would be, I don't think that makes a difference. That is, I still face the same thing. This weird thing that has come out of left field could still be rooted in a misunderstanding of what God wants and a desire to follow God. It could be rooted in a genuine desire to follow God. Or, as is often the case with weird things that come out of left field, it's just willfulness on my part. I don't really want to submit to what God has shown us in His Word. What I want is my own little bizarre take on things. So both of those things would be possible. And again, I'm just trying to have the discernment to sort out what am I dealing with, I think. Okay, we're out of time. We'll have one last question.
Now, what you were talking about, there's an issue people are fighting over, should we or should we not eat meat to idols, or whatever this meat. And what I'm hearing him saying is, don't let that be what you're fighting about. If you have a disagreement, that's the outcome of a chain of thought. And if you guys want to go back and talk about the chain of thought, that's a whole other world. But when it comes down, until that's settled, don't fight over this one thing and don't insult your brother. Just kind of go along, go with the flow a little bit and avoid making it an issue that can't be dealt with lovingly so that you can talk later about why you do or don't think that it's okay to eat this meat, but it's not because you're fighting about it because you just insulted me. It's more like, no, there's something interesting here about the way God works in Scripture that might make you change how you're thinking about that. So it's a surface opportunity for conflict versus an underlying discussion of theology, and that both people are trying to understand the theology with a good, clear conscience, lovingly to one another. And he's saying in this case, don't kick the dog. That's not going to be helpful to you. Another time he might say, well, you know what? You need to get their attention. You know, in this particular instance, you might need to get their attention and right. Do something. But generally, in this case, no, go along with it and work on it behind the scenes.
Okay, I think I might buy that, if I'm understanding what you're saying. I think it would be clear as we look at how Paul thinks about things that he would encourage continued discussion and a desire to understand what is the truth of that issue. He's not saying, oh, it doesn't matter. I mean, he does say at one point, who are you to judge the servant of another? His own, that's the one before his own master, he'll stand or fall, and God is able to make him stand. This picture ultimately that God is quite capable of bringing him along, and if he needs to mature in his understanding, then God is quite capable of bringing that about. So we are to be patient while that process is happening. But it does imply that it's not static. I mean, we're not just staying here locked into our positions. We're seeking to mature in our understanding, and that would be true for everyone involved. If there is a discussion like that, both sides ought to be listening to the other and saying, am I missing something here? So yeah, I think all of that would be true. And if that's related to what you're saying, then yes, I agree with that. Okay.